Maybe the Lord was wanted us to have a seminar on global warming, something like that. You think? Except evolution's a lot more silly than that. Okay, the science piece. That's what I'm about to go through. Let's talk about time today. Evolutionists believe that the process of evolution takes a lot of time. And so they speak in terms of billions and millions of years. Billions and millions of years. It's a lot of time. And the evolutionists preach, given enough time, anything, everything can happen. Obviously, the theory of evolution is at odds with the Bible. The Bible is directly against this idea. The controversy is very clear. When it comes to the age of the earth, the Bible says in 6 days God made the heavens and the earth. The evolutionists say the earth is 4.6 billion years old. That's a big difference. And naturally, many seek a compromise. So you have here Reverend Michael Dowd. He's the evolution preacher. And he goes across the country promoting his book. Thank God for evolution. He has the Jesus fish and the Darwin fish kissing there. So many believe that theistic evolution is a compromise. But if you're a Bible believer, there can be no compromise. The question is, according to the Bible, how long is a day? Biblically, how long is a day? I mean, some people believe that each of the days in Genesis were actually millions of years, ages. They call this the day-age theory. But what saith the Scriptures? Since we are Bible believers, we should see that. And here's an example of some Scriptures. In Genesis 1, verse 5, and there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Verse 8, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. Verse 13, and there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. So for each day of creation, the pattern is very clear. Evening, morning, number, day. And just a part of this pattern, evening and day together, give us a 24-hour solar day. But it seems like God's going out of his way here. All right, he's giving us evening, morning, and number to convince us that you don't have to go to the Hebrew in plain English. It's very easy to see that we're talking about a 24-hour solar day. 6 days. And if you turn to Exodus 20:11, there's even further proof of this conclusion. It says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. God wrote this with his own finger in stone. In 6 days, he made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Okay, so there is no compromise here. Just a little question aside here. Just wondering what the Vatican's position is on this issue. Well, if you've read your catechism lately, in Catechism 337, the Catechism explains that Scripture presents the work of the Creator symbolically as a succession of 6 days of divine work concluded by the rest of the seventh day. But nothing exists that does not owe its existence to God, the Creator. So the Catholics are giving God the credit, at least the Catechism, but they're just not taking God literally, that's all. All right. Some of you know that the Vatican employs astronomers, even operates its own observatory. And many Catholics would think that, or expect, these astronomers, these scientists, these Catholic scientists, to defend the Scriptures. But that's not the case. In some of their quotes, you see that they consider creationists as pagans, because creationists believed in literal days. Some of their top officials say that it's a superstition to believe in literal days. That's just an aside. Also, while we're here, I need to mention something that Pastor covered in depth not too long ago. The five worlds that are revealed in Scripture. Maybe you remember this handout. And the only reason I mention this is because young earth creationists, many of which are Christians, disagree with making a division between verses 2 and 3 in Genesis 1. They refer to this as the gap theory. They think that's bad theology. I don't think it's bad theology. But they also say that it's a cop-out. They say its main purpose is to try to reconcile the billions of years with a biblical framework. Well, that's not why we preached five worlds here. That's not our reasons for doing so. And as Bible believers, you need to know that because we believe the Word of God is perfect, inerrant, true, it means what it says, that God doesn't create anything without form and void. Create isn't the same as made. Fill isn't the same as replenish. And a new earth isn't promised to us until the old has passed away. So this is just an aside, but just in summary, and of course you can speak to Pastor about this. All right, it's just, it has been criticized as a compromise. So now the question is, how do evolutionists measure time? How do they come up with this 4.6 billion years of the age of the earth? Well, radioisotope dating is what they have. They say that is the most consistent, the most reliable method, also known as radiometric dating. For doing this. So they say that these methods allow us to come up with absolute ages of rocks and the age of the Earth. And let's see. What is radioisotope dating? Radioisotope dating is the process of estimating the age of rocks from the decay of their radioactive elements. There are certain kinds of atoms in nature that are unstable, and they spontaneously decay or change into other kinds of atoms. For example, uranium spontaneously decays. It breaks down through a series of steps until finally it ends up with lead. So uranium is a good example as a radiometric dating method because when it comes to rocks, this is the one most often reported. The uranium lead. Uranium is referred to as the parent element. And that uranium, step by step, will break down consistently until we end up with a stable element known as lead, the daughter element. Now, when it comes to the types of rocks that they date, radioisotopic dating is used for igneous rocks. And igneous rocks are rocks that are formed when hot, molten material cools down and solidifies. And amongst igneous rocks, you have granite, which are considered the oldest rocks in the world, and basalt, also known as lava. So the radioisotope clock starts when a rock cools down. And what happens is from that point, the parent, which is uranium in this case, changes into the daughter, lead. Which is the element that begins to build up as time proceeds. All right. The dating process then involves two steps. One is measuring how much daughter and how much parent element is there in that rock sample that they're dating, and then knowing the decay rate. In other words, how long it takes for the parent element to decay into a daughter element. And the decay rate is measured in terms of half-life. Maybe you're familiar with that term. Half-life is defined as the length of time it takes for half of the atoms of a radioactive parent element to decay. And as you could tell, half-life varies depending on the isotope. I mean, some isotopes, as polonium all the way up on top, 218, has a half-life of 3 minutes. And then on the other extreme, you have uranium, which I just mentioned, and its daughter having a half-life of 4.47 billion years. Can you wrap your mind around that? 4.47 billion years. Rubidium, 48.8 billion years, even a longer half-life. So what I want to do is, first of all, since I'm a high school science teacher, just a high school science teacher, I'm no professor, I just want to give you an example of a typical problem that I would give in class, since this is a topic in chemistry, with half-life. And, for example, a rock contains 100 grams of PO218, polonium-218. That's the one that has a half-life of 3 minutes. How much time will it take for it to decay to 6.25 grams? Well, again, if we understand the way this works, going forward in time, that 100 grams after the first half-life, after the first 3 minutes, becomes 50 grams of polonium. And then 25 grams after the second half-life, 12.5 grams after the third half-life. You keep having it, in other words. And finally, after four half-lives, what remains is the 6.25 grams. So four half-lives times 3 minutes per half-life means 12 minutes from now. In 12 minutes from now, you'll have 6.25 grams of polonium. The remainder of that 100 grams is what the polonium turns into, its daughter element. And so many people would ask me here, so what's wrong with that? What's the problem? Well, going forwards in time, there is no problem. Going forwards in time, you're making observations in the present. And this thing works beautifully. All right, this is a high school level problem, which is the extent to which most people, if any of you here took high school chemistry, were exposed to this. And so you're left with an impression of accuracy and precision about this method. But we need to go in the opposite direction, because that's where the problems go. Okay? Suppose I were to ask you, which is a college level problem now, determine the age of this rock. I give you a rock. Based on the amount of uranium and lead that's in it. Now, this is not rocket science either. This is still a college-level problem. And so what you would do is you'd have to determine the amount of parent and daughter isotopes that are present in that rock at the moment. And you probably would be given that information. Unless you were a graduate student, you'd measure it yourself. You'd use an instrument called a mass spectrometer, an instrument that measures how much parent and how much daughter is there in the rock at the moment. And then second, you'd plug in these quantities into an equation known as a rate law, because it turns out that radioactive decay obeys first-order kinetics. All right, and so you do these calculations. And there's no problem with doing these calculations. But it's not a question of your ability to do these calculations, because even your answer that you come up with is still flawed with assumptions. And if you don't consider those assumptions, because you're going backwards in time, then you don't realize the problem. All right. And curiously, many college textbooks, all the ones I've read, never mention the assumptions of going backwards in time with this. And so that's what I want to look at today. This thing is flawed. It's a so-called tool that's flawed with assumptions that we need to consider. And scientists ought to consider, too. Radiometric dating uses scientific techniques in the present and assumptions about historical events in the past to estimate what a rock age is. Observational science is used to measure the amount of the parent, how much parent is there and daughter element is present within a rock. And observational science can be used to determine the present observable rate of decay. Those half-lives, if you observe them at the moment, presently, even though no one is going to be here so many billions of years from now, those half-lives can be analyzed statistically. There's no problem with the present going forward. It's going backwards that we have problems. See, because when it comes to determining the conditions present when that rock was first formed, or how the environment may have impacted that rock over billions and millions of years, now you're talking about historical science. You're making assumptions about the original composition of that rock. You're making assumptions about the environmental impact on that rock. So you have to realize these two things come together. It's not just observational science in the here and now. It relies on assumptions in the past. And maybe this will help. Because sometimes when we go into a science lesson, we turn off. We say, that's science and math. I can't understand that. So here's a good way to understand this. An analogy for dating rocks. Suppose you enter into a room and you see an hourglass. It's been turned over already. All right, and you're asked, can you calculate how long has that hourglass been running? It's turned over and you see the sand is running. Well, you say, sure, no problem. I'll estimate how fast the sand is falling. I'll measure how much sand is at the bottom of that hourglass. And then I'll calculate how much time has elapsed. But you realize you've made some assumptions too in doing so. You need to consider those assumptions. Was there any sand at the bottom of that hourglass before it was turned over? You're assuming there wasn't. But that will affect your calculation, you realize. This might seem silly in the case of the hourglass, but when it comes to rocks, it's important. In analogy, has any sand been added or taken out of the hourglass? Now, you're saying it's a closed system, but rocks aren't. They're not closed systems. And thirdly, has the sand always been falling at a constant rate? You're assuming that it has always been falling at a constant rate. Well, what if the sand was moist or wetter or drier? That would change the rate at which the sand comes down. That's important to know. Now, all your calculations with the hourglass could be correct, all right? But you still have to consider some critical assumptions that you've made. And it's the same thing with radioisotope dating. We'll see that today. See, by analogy, what I'm saying is that in this case here, the uranium, if we use the uranium as the parent and the lead as the daughter element, the uranium is the sand that you find at the top of the glass. There's a certain amount of uranium atoms there. And the rate at which that sand is falling is analogous to the rate of radioactive decay. And by analogy, too, what I'm saying is that the amount of sand at the bottom is the lead, the daughter element that you find. All right, now, it's important to note that to date a rock, the geologists first have to measure the sand grains in the top glass bowl. And second, they have to measure the sand grains in the bottom glass bowl. And then based on their observations of measurements and the known rate of decay, they're going to tell you how much time has elapsed based on how much daughter has accumulated relative to parent. See, but unlike the hourglass, you could take a sand hourglass and you could turn it upside down and place it alongside another clock to test how accurate it is. You can't do this with a rock. There are three unprovable assumptions that radioisotopic dating is based on. There is no clock to check it against. And you need to consider that. Assumption number one is the conditions at time zero. You see, the assumption is that the original number of unstable atoms can be known. Was that true? Scientists assume how many unstable parent atoms existed at the beginning based on how many parent and daughter atoms are left today. But there was no geologist there at the beginning, millions and billions of years ago, when these rocks formed. Secondly, scientists assume the rate of change was constant. I mean, it's been constant ever since, at least in a recent time frame, so they're going to assume it's constant even back then. Scientists also assume that the daughter atoms were all produced by radioactive decay. So we're going to have to look at those assumptions, see what's wrong with that. First of all, as far as the facts are concerned, we know that radioisotope dating does not always work, because we can test it on rocks of known age. There's plenty of evidence out there for this. All right? For example, rocks formed in Mount St. Helens in 1986 yielded a radiometric age of 350,000 years. How can that be? This system is reliable, is consistent. Here's a rock of known age that is giving us a year of 350,000. How's that possible? Another example. A rock formed by lava flows at Mount Nauru in 1954 yielded radiometric ages of 3.5 million years. I don't know, do your math. 1954 was not 3.5 million years ago. Show you that. Also, a rock formed by lava flows. Oh, I gave you this one. Yeah. A little discoordinated. A rock at the top of the Grand Canyon, formed by a recent volcanic eruption, yielded the same age as volcanic rocks deep below the canyon wall. Rocks above and below the canyon wall are giving you the same age. How could that be? The age was 1.143 billion years. And when these rocks were tested with different methods, the ages were even more different. From 1.143 billion years, we had with the samarium neodymium method, 916 million years. With the uranium lead method, which is the most common, it was 2.6 billion years. That's a significant difference. You need to consider that. So the point is that there's a tremendous amount of scatter here. And in answer to this, because these are all methods in which they call them single sample methods, where you just take a sample from a rock and you test it. The answer that they give us to this, the rebuttal is there's a better method called the isochron dating method. Let's talk a little bit about that. The isochron dating method is another radiometric dating method that analyzes four more samples from a rock. And so what they're telling us is when you do this, when you analyze multiple samples from a rock and you put it through this analysis, you eliminate any assumptions that you've made about the starting conditions. Now, if that's true, then the single sample and the isochron dating methods, if they're truly reliable, then they should agree with each other. And that's frequently not the case. For example, here are the results of a study done by the Rake Group. The Beartooth Mountains are considered the oldest mountains in the United States. They contain the oldest rocks. And what they did was they analyzed many samples with different methods. And look at the ages that they came up with. With the potassium argon single sample method, testing different minerals within the same rock, you see the beginning point there, an age of 1,520 million years. Then when you compare that to the age of the whole rock was greater in age, 2,011 million years. And then minerals within that same rock with the same method give us 2,403 million years. So we have a tremendous amount of scatter within samples of one rock, and then if you take those same rocks and you analyze them with the isochron dating method, you get even more scatter. Look at these dates here. All right, the rubidium-strontium method gives us 2,515 million years. And so on and so on. And the lead-lead method, 2,689 years. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of scatter here, all right, between the methods, and a tremendous amount of scatter here within one method itself. All right. So the assumption is a problem. The assumption they're making there about the original quantity of parent and daughter to begin with. Something else. This assumption about no contamination. Our scientists do not know how much the rocks have been contaminated. So they usually assume there's no contamination. In other words, no daughter isotopes could have been added or taken away. Well, is that true? It turns out contamination of lava flows again at Mount Nauru, known to be less than 50 years old, yielded three different ages for rocks. 133 million years, 197 million years, and 3.908 billion years. Tremendous difference. If you could appreciate, when someone reports this, you know, someone's not gonna get a PhD reporting data like this to prove the consistency of their method. It's very inconsistent. Now the question is, how do we account for contamination, or what are possible routes of contamination? Well, first of all, how about water? Rainfall that's flowing, seeping through the rocks, which could add and subtract the daughter isotopes. How about the fact when lava comes through the earth, as it comes through a conduit, it could pick up rocks from the conduit wall itself, which mix and contaminate your sample. That's very possible. That's something we need to consider. So now, the question is, when radioisotope dating fails to give accurate dates on rocks of known age, why should we trust it for rocks of unknown age? It just doesn't make sense to me. Maybe it does to you. And here's something that's a common question. A common question that I give, and I'm sure if you've had chemistry, if you remember it recently, I give to my students, and the question is, as temperature increases, half-life does what? Well, the answer that the state wants, of course, is half-life remains the same. And the question is that really true? Is half-life a constant? Well, physicists have measured radioactive decay for the past 100 years or so, and they've seen by changing temperature and changing pressure, sure, they haven't changed significantly the half-lives of these isotopes. But when you start talking about billions of years, you're talking about a tremendous extrapolation of time. From hundreds to billions going backwards, to assume that the radioactive decay rate was constant? I'm not willing to assume that. Are you? There's a recent study done by the Rake Group that has proven, or that indicates, better said, that the radioactive decay does not have to be constant. In granites are these crystals called zircon crystals. And zircon crystals contain the uranium turning into lead, decaying into lead. But it turns out also that as that uranium turns into lead, it produces helium. For every atom of uranium that decays in a series of steps to form lead, which is your stable isotope, 8 helium atoms are produced. And those helium atoms, just like the helium you and I are exposed to, will diffuse out of that rock. They'll migrate or escape out of that rock. Now, the decay of the uranium is a slow process. It has a half-life, we're told, of 4.5 billion years. And since the helium diffuses out of these rocks rapidly, if it leaks out of these rocks rapidly, then there should be very little helium left in these granites. But to everybody's surprise, there's a lot more helium found inside these zircon crystals than we can account for. So the Rake study proposed something different. The question is, why is so much helium still in the granite, in these zircons? They said, well, we need to attack the assumption of the fact that the rate of decay is constant. No, this is proof possibly of accelerated radioactive decay. Accelerate so much that the helium was being produced faster than it could have escaped from the rock. For example, the radioactive decay of uranium in zircon crystals in a New Mexico granite yielded a uranium lead age of 1.5 billion years. In other words, based on those three assumptions, the method as it is, they came up with an age of 1.5 billion years. But the same uranium decay, remember, produced helium. And it produced, in this case, only about 6,000 years worth of helium. Isn't that an interesting date? And it's 6,000 years that it was found to have leaked out of these crystals. So the only way we can account for that is through accelerated decay. At some point in time, uranium probably broke down a lot faster. In fact, in this case here, I have the number for you. This means that the uranium must have decayed very rapidly over the same 6,000 years. The rate of uranium decay, if you take these two ratios here, would be 250,000 times faster than today's measured rate. All right, so it's possible that 1.5 billion years, or million years, billion years in this case, occurred in 6,000 years. Why not? All right. Something else. People always ask, well, is there anything that would confirm this rate study? And yes, there is. There are these things called radio halos. Radio halos are produced because of the physical damage that's caused by uranium and its daughter atoms when it decays. And so it makes these marks, like these fingerprints, in the granites. All right, well, if you look at this more carefully, though, you'll see that these markings in the granites called radio halos, each one of them is attributed to the different daughter isotopes of uranium. It turns out that the uranium and polonium radio halos exist adjacent to each other, side by side, in the same granite. Now, how do we explain that? Now, remember, the uranium is the supply. Through its decay, the uranium supplies the daughter isotopes of polonium, PO218, and polonium-210. But remember, this polonium, as I told you in the very beginning, has a half-life of 3 minutes. So that damage that the polonium made probably have occurred within hours or days. So for these radio halos to exist side by side, all right, that means that the polonium atoms had to be supplied at a certain rate, a much faster rate than the uranium normally decays. In other words, in this time frame, to produce these radio halos side by side, the uranium had to decay at an accelerated pace, a much faster pace than we could measure today. So we have some confirmation with radio halos. The hundreds of millions of years worth of uranium decay, as estimated, compared to today's slow decay rate, had to have occurred within hours to a few days to produce those adjacent uranium and polonium radio halos. So there is enough scientific evidence out there, if you speak about radioactive decay, for you, the Christian, to have a rebuttal, is my point. Now, as far as evidence for a young Earth, the evidence for a young Earth is powerful. It's all over the place. All you have to do is Google this. All right? There's evidence from the stars. There's evidence from our solar system. There's evidence from the moon. There's evidence from the atmosphere. And we can go on and on and on with this. I'll just give you a couple examples. All right? First of all, let's talk about the evidence from the stars. There are these high-energy stars that astronomers speak about and write about all the time. They're shining or radiating so much more than our sun that they could not have possibly survived billions of years based on the current theory of what produces that light, which is the hydrogen that these stars contain. They would have died out a long, long time ago if indeed the universe is billions of years old, and yet they're still there. Another example, evidence from the sun, and there's so many of these, but I'll just give you some today. Something called solar collapse. All right, it's been known by studies that the sun is gradually shrinking at a steady rate. All right, now, if you take that shrinkage and go in the reverse direction, well, if it's shrinking now, let's go in the reverse direction and consider how big the sun was so many years ago. 50,000 years ago, not billions of years ago, 50,000 years ago, the sun would have been so large that our oceans would have boiled. And long before that, there would have been no life because it would have been so hot on Earth. Talking about physical evidence that you could give to an evolutionist to see physical evidence for a young Earth. All right? Something else. Evidence from the atmosphere, the air that we now breathe. Well, if uranium, the decay of uranium and other isotopes is the source of uranium, is the source of helium, and there's that this has been going on for billions and billions of years, then there should be a lot more helium in the atmosphere than we have. All right? The amount of helium on our planet is far too small for billions of years if our world has existed for so many ages. Now, the rebuttal to this is that, well, the helium escapes into outer space. Well, there's no proof of that. In fact, the contrary. The helium just can't reach that velocity. Maybe hydrogen can escape into outer space, but not the helium. Evidence for a young Earth. Evidence for meteors. All the meteorites discovered are always near the Earth's surface. They're always shallow. None are ever found in the deeper, older, sedimentary strata. It's known as the geologic column. Why is that so? If the geologic column, according to them, was formed over the years, you have these layers just waiting for meteors to fall upon them, then they should be found everywhere in all depths of the geologic column. But they're only found shallow. Why is that? Evidence for a young Earth. I like this one here. The spin of the Earth, which is now about 1,000 miles an hour, is gradually slowing down. That's undebatable. Now, if you go in the reverse direction, if you extrapolate backwards, since it's slowing down now, going backwards, it's speeding up, correct? Go back with this present rate of spin backwards 5 billion years ago, because they're telling us the Earth is 4.6 billion years, the planet would have had to be spinning so fast that it would have changed its shape into a flat pancake. We would have went from that to that. And we'd still be living in a planet like that. The magnetic field decay. No scientist is going to argue this either. It's provable that the magnetic field of the Earth, that's why your compass points north and south, right, is decaying at a certain rate. They even speak about the half-life of the decay, magnetic decay. And what happens to that energy? Well, that energy is transformed into heat. Take it backwards. 1 million years back, that energy was transformed into heat and heats the Earth, correct? Well, the Earth would have had, first of all, if its magnetic field is decaying, working it backwards, that means its magnetic field would have to be getting greater and greater and stronger. If you work it back 1 million years, that means the Earth would have had greater magnetism than all objects in our universe. And the Earth would have vaporized because of the heat. See, when you take it forward, I have no problem. When you take it backwards and extrapolate backwards, that's where you get the evolutionists, because it just doesn't make sense in the time frame they're talking about. Evidence, I mean, we can go on and on, but I'll just give you a couple more. Evidence from beneath the surface of the Earth that it is quite young, proof that it is quite young. The gas that's escaping, the natural gas that you and I use, all right, it's trapped underneath the Earth, underneath the shale. It's in porous rock trapped under shale, but it still escapes at a certain rate. If the world were billions of years old, all the natural gas will already have escaped. And if the world were billions of years old, the oil pressure that we see with these oil geysers would not be as high as it is today. That oil pressure is maybe 7,000 to 10,000 years old. It would just dissipate over millions and billions of years. Niagara Falls. How many of you have been to Niagara Falls? The falls erodes the cliff beneath it at a rate of about 3.5 feet per year. That's known. It's been measured. There's no debate on it. Well, since the length of the Niagara Falls gorge is about 7 miles, then the age of the falls would be about from 5 to 10,000 years old. Not billions and billions of years old. It just doesn't make sense. How about those sequoias of California? Those sequoias have, the only enemy to the sequoia is man who chops them down. Those sequoias live on and on and on. There's no proof that they would die. Centuries old. But the sequoias are never older than about 4,000 years, which brings us back to the flood, doesn't it? How about evidence from civilization? Right? If mankind has been living and working on planet Earth for millions of years, why do we find records of man only dating back to about 2,300-3,500 BC? Where are the rest of the records? And the final authority, of course, the biblical records. The Bible, don't put your Bible away. That Bible has archaeological backing and historical proof to it. And that Bible, according to Genesis, creation week was about 4,000 BC. I'm going to trust that Bible for that. And the date of the flood, about 2348. Don't quote me on that one. All right, so here's the bottom line. I'm not an expert. All right, not a PhD, obviously. I did a little research. You can do it too. You can Google it. And when you find, what you'll find is a rebuttal to each one of these points. Somebody said they wouldn't come today unless there were a debate. Okay, let me give you the debate. This is a lie, 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 this is a lie. There's your debate. Because that's what it boils down to. The evidence is there, as the brother said. It all depends on your glasses. It all depends on your starting point. The Word of God is more powerful and quick, huh? Look at this. This is really the bottom line to me. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in politicians. To put your confidence, yeah, politicians, right? The businessmen, right? Put your confidence in scientists. Even to put your confidence in yourself. It's better to trust in the Lord. And that's the bottom line on this thing. Who are you going to trust? I'll trust the Lord. All right? Thank you.